Today is Thursday, November 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, in what could have major implications for the Russia investigation, the president forces his attorney general to retire.
I find the timing very suspect.
The president hailing Republican Senate victories while seeming to ignore they lost control of the House.
As an example of the 11 candidates we campaigned with during the last week, 9 won.
A meeting between the U.S. and North Korean officials has been suddenly canceled. And a singer with one of the biggest hits in 2018 has just released a new single. It's all on today's International Edition. The political landscape shifted in Washington this week in the wake of the 2018 congressional midterm elections. Democrats won back control of the House of Representatives while Republicans expanded their majority in the Senate. The election returns amounted to what many see as a split midterm verdict on Donald Trump's presidency. Riding solid gains for Democratic candidates in the U.S. midterm elections are two candidates that are now set to make history in January when they become the first Muslim American women in the U.S. Congress. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, expectations are high for both Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar as they seek to influence U.S. policy on issues ranging from immigration reform to policy, foreign policy.
Casting a vote for former state lawmaker and congressional candidate Rashida Tlaib wasn't about making history for Detroit voter David White. It was about making a difference.
Rashida represents everything that undermines those stereotypes. She doesn't just appeal to a Muslim community. I mean, she appeals to a wide swath of individuals, and it just so happens that she is a Muslim. That doesn't define you, and it shouldn't define you in the eyes of the nation.
It also didn't define Somali refugee and Minnesota congressional candidate Democrat Ilhan Omar to a diverse coalition of voters that helped her defeat the Republican challenger in her Minneapolis district.
Tonight, throughout, not only in my race, but throughout the country, people are choosing hope over fear and unity over division.
While both women were elected in districts that heavily favored their political party, voters like Allison Brooks, who cast her ballot in the same Detroit polling location as Rashida Tlaib, says this historic moment was a long time coming.
It's crazy that it's 2018 and, you know, this could be possibly the first time that this is happening. So, I mean, we need more Muslims in Congress and in the House and Senate.
Being Arab and being Muslim is always going to be part of who I am. But just like Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he was all about justice. So much of my faith is very much embedded in that justice.
Tlaib, who also becomes the first Palestinian-American in Congress, promises her reputation as an outspoken critic of President Donald Trump and his administration's policies isn't going to change as she makes the transition from candidate to congresswoman.
It's never going to happen. Yeah, it's just not in me. I think people say to me all the time, we want a different, and that's why we voted for you. We need somebody that's going to go in and fight.
A fight voter David White is confident she will deliver.
Standing up in the middle of a speech and, you know, shouting him down, we need some of that, right? We need some of that strong resistance, even though I don't necessarily identify, you know, with that style.
Rashida! Rashida!
A style that will be put to the test come January, when Tlaib and Omar enter Congress as freshman lawmakers in a chamber their party will control.
Now I get to march into the United States Capitol.
Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Detroit, Michigan.
Well, less than 24 hours after the midterms, before Congress is back in session and Democrats take control, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was asked by the president to resign. Sessions had been under pressure by Trump ever since he recused himself from the special counsel probe in Russia's interference into the 2016 U.S. presidential election, which Trump wants to end. He criticized the investigation again at a news conference on Wednesday.
It's a disgrace. It should have never been started because there was no crime. Everybody has conflicts. They all have conflicts over there that are beyond anything that anybody's ever seen in terms of conflicts.
AP correspondent Eric Tucker says the president never made a secret of his displeasure with Sessions.
The relationship between President Trump and Attorney General Sessions has been difficult, even toxic, for more than a year and a half now. This all goes back to March 2017, when Sessions, in his very first press conference, announced that he was recusing from the Russian investigation. And that was a decision that made President Trump irate. He has repeatedly said that had he known that Sessions was going to recuse, he would have never picked him in the first place.
Well, Tucker says that there are signals that the new acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, a conservative Republican from Iowa, is a Trump loyalist who isn't friendly toward the continuing Russia investigation.
Matt Whitaker, in a prior life as a CNN commentator, as a conservative former United States attorney, has been sort of skeptical about elements of the Mueller investigation. He has suggested that Trump was within his rights to consider Mueller to have crossed a red line if he began investigating Trump's finances. He has indicated that he was not someone who wanted to give Mueller carte blanche.
Well, Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer expressed his concern.
Our paramount view is that any attorney general, whether this one or another one, should not be able to interfere with the Mueller investigation in any way.
Well, joining us now to talk more about all of this and what it means going forward is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. It hasn't been a secret that the president has been very unhappy with Sessions because of his recusal and that he's wanted him to go. It was sort of expected, maybe not this quickly after the midterms, but it was definitely expected. Do you think that special counsel Robert Mueller planned for this and anticipated it?
I do. If we look at what Bob Mueller has actually done in the last couple of indictments, is they're actually full of information. In fact, even more information than you would normally see in an indictment. You put in just what you need to establish probable cause. In this case, he puts in a lot more. And I think the purpose of that is to get that information out in the public realm. So that is a part of it. And I think he sees the pressure that's coming at him. He's a long-standing, very experienced prosecutor who knows the political elements that are swirling around him and is preparing for those. My expectation is that he knows that he only has so much time here, and he's got to start making some quick decisions, and I suspect that he is.
I would assume that Whitaker is immediately taking over the Russia investigation. I don't know that there's any wait time. Would you say that's accurate?
That appears to be accurate. Here's our problem. The problem is we have never seen anything quite like this. The question is could an acting attorney general have the power and ability to remove special counsel? Technically, it says attorney general. It essentially says the person in charge, if you will. It doesn't say acting or not. Mm-hmm. And so the perception is he likely does. But again, this starts to feed into this question of obstruction again. And so you have to look at that issue. The real question at this point is what Congress should be doing in terms of their oversight capability. And we've seen over the last, year and a half or so, that there's been essentially no oversight in either the House or the Senate when it comes to this investigation, or what the behavior of the president has been. So that's the real question, too.
Now the Democrats are about to take control of the House, but that's not until January. So could he potentially be doing all of this in this interim period to try to protect himself?
Yes, he could. In fact, you could see this as a sort of pulling off the Band-Aid. You do this very, very quickly. Mm. The idea that maybe what you could have done is fired Jeff Sessions, fired Rod Rosenstein, brought in somebody who's been number four man in terms of that issue, or you could have brought in somebody like a Matthew Whitaker, mm-hmm, who could come in and do this. And that does seem to be consistent with the kind of behavior we've seen from this president over the last year and a half, plus all the way through the election cycle back before 2016.
If the president somehow made a deal with Whitaker that if I appoint you to be the next attorney general or as acting attorney general, will you promise to shut down this investigation? Is that legal if that
No.
were in fact what happened?
No, it's actually not legal. In fact, when you're going to take a position like this, the president can't squeeze that kind of a promise out of you. Although, if you take a look back at what James Comey said when he was getting cornered in the Oval Office from the president looking for loyalty, this could be consistent with that issue. And again, what we know about Matthew Whitaker is that he has been very loyal to this president, specifically not to the presidency, but to this president alone. Again, being seen as the eyes and ears inside of justice, also being at the White House again and again and sitting down with the president, and apparently the president likes him. He also likes some of his other background, including the fact that he was a football player and some other issues too. That really brings up a whole series of questions of what promises or obligations have been made already behind the scenes.
But how would we find out? Would that be? We wouldn't.
No, we wouldn't, because in this particular case, they're not going to sit down and have somebody as a secretary following this issue. You can look back at previous presidents, and frequently anything that was being done, you would have a stenographer there. You would actually have somebody taking all this down for posterity. So this is something we saw with President Obama. This is something we saw with the Bushes. This is something we saw with Bill Clinton. But what we found is that when this president took office, that behavior, those steps that were taken were essentially stopped. Mm-hmm. And so some of the things that are going on simply disappear, vanish into history.
Because Democrats have now taken control of the House, and we know that since Republicans still control the Senate by a slightly wider majority now, does Congress have any ability to keep this situation in check and stop the president from allowing Mueller and the investigation to be stopped?
That's a wonderful question. No one's ever done it. And that is really where we are right now.
What do you think is going to happen? Is this investigation pretty much killed? Is it done?
No. No, I really don't think that it is done. What I do think is that Bob Mueller saw this coming and sees this coming. I think that his people, there's an understanding of justice that you're not supposed to bring indictments during the election process because you don't want to impact the political process of this. I know we've had limitations when it comes to that, but that is something that I think Bob Mueller was very, very conscious of. Mm-hmm. But what I also think he was conscious of was mm-hmm. that when the election is over, he's got to step up, and he's got to step up fast. He's got to step up, and he's got to present what it is that he has, because he knows that he's under enormous pressure to do so.
All right, that is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The Trump administration is facing new investigations. Bahrain continues to revoke citizenship of dissidents. 400,000 malnourished children are at risk of dying in war-torn Yemen. And school children in Cameroon released days after the abduction by separatists. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo planned his planned meeting with a senior North Korean official Thursday. This in New York City has been postponed. The State Department issued a statement on Wednesday saying the meeting will now take place at a later date. It didn't give a reason why it was canceled. Pompeo was slated to hold talks with a senior advisor to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And in announcing the meeting earlier this week, the State Department said the two men would discuss making progress on all four pillars of the Singapore summit joint statement, including achieving the final fully verified denuclearization of North Korea. In his Wednesday news conference, President Trump said the decision not to meet Thursday was due to scheduling problems. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Joel Witt, senior fellow at the Stimson Center, if there might be more to this cancellation of the meeting.
Joining us on VOA Asia is Joel Witt, senior fellow at the Stimson Center and the director of the 38 North website. Joel, thanks for being with us. In his press conference Wednesday, President Trump said the decision not to meet on Thursday between the Secretary of State and the North Korean official was due to scheduling problems and that it would be rescheduled. Do you think there's more to it than that?
Well, I think that's very strange because they had only shortly before announced the details of the visit. And the week before, Secretary Pompeo kept hinting at, you know, this was going to happen. So, you know, in order to do all of that, they had to work out the travel details. And my understanding is the North Koreans had their plane reservations to come to New York. So it seems to me there must be some other explanation.
Would you care to venture a guess?
Yes, and well, that's exactly what it would be. It would be a guess. So there are a lot of different possibilities. One of them is that the North Koreans decided at the last minute that it just wasn't worthwhile meeting at this point because the positions are so far apart. And so a meeting might actually have a negative impact on the process. Another one is, you know, the United States may have gotten some cold feet, too. You know, I think there is opposition inside the Trump administration to what President Trump is doing. President Trump is really forward-leaning, and the rest of his administration is actually backward-leaning in terms of dealing with North Korea. So there may be some internal glitches going on there. And the last possibility is that maybe the North Koreans have basically decided they just want to wait until the next summit where they can deal with President Trump, who they much prefer to deal with.
How much room is there for not letting it get out of hand?
That's an excellent question, because I think what we're seeing and what we've been seeing since the Singapore summit is a gradual erosion of this process. At least from my perspective, the summit was a promising start. But since then, we've seen a lot of backsliding from what President Trump promised. And, you know, I think the North Koreans are starting to get cold feet. They're starting to doubt whether the Trump administration is a reliable negotiating partner. And I can only wonder what the results of yesterday's election had on that calculation, because they may think that President Trump now is going to be tied down with all sorts of domestic political squabbles, and that may make him less reliable.
All right, that's Joel Witt, senior fellow at the Stimson Center. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
VOA's International Edition continues. A just-released book by Pulitzer Prize-winning national security correspondent for The Washington Post, Greg Miller, draws on the entire post-national security team, reporting in interviews on Russia's interference in the 2016 elections and the turmoil that followed. The book is titled The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy, and he discusses it now with us. What compelled you to write the book, and how did it all come about?
I think there's kind of two answers there. One is this really is built on the reporting that we were doing at the Washington Post in 2016 and 2017. It won the Pulitzer Prize this year. And, you know, we broke a lot of stories. We broke stories about Mike Flynn. We were the first to report that the DNC had been hacked. We were the first to report that the CIA had reached a conclusion that Russia was trying to help elect Donald Trump. And so publishers were coming to the Post during that time and asking, you know, interested in a book by the Post writers responsible for these stories. And that's really how this came together. I think that the benefit for readers, and frankly for myself even, it was to be able to sit down and do this in a book in a way that puts together this story in a comprehensible way. Because when we were writing these breaking stories week to week, day to day, sometimes it was so easy to get lost and to fail to see connections that really jump out at you when you really lay them out on a single timeline?
Right. I mean, certainly the news cycle in the past year and a half since President Trump was elected has been a whirlwind of changing events constantly. And so, of course, with the Russia, there's so many layers to it. And it sounds like it would be logical to put it all together that way. But it's based on all the research and the articles, but it's written in book form.
And there's a ton of new reporting here. You know, it starts with those sort of some of those initial stories, but I've gone back through and re-interviewed people we knew at the time and were talking to at the time to get really behind-the-scenes detail on things that were happening inside the DNC and during the hack and at the CIA when they sort of start to catch wind of this, then inside the Obama White House. And as you said, this book doesn't really, it's not just a retrospective on the election, it's current. It takes us right up to the current moment in the Trump-Russia investigation by Robert Mueller. So there are details inside of this unraveling of Trump's legal team earlier this year, his unresolved showdown with Mueller over whether Trump is ever going to sit down for an interview with him. So it's just tying all of that together in a book that I think reads more like a novel or a screenplay.
We don't know the conclusion yet. How were you able to piece it together without that? Special Counsel Mueller's investigation has not concluded.
Yeah, so I sort of look at this as a three-act play, and we've been through Act Two. And Mueller, we're not sure when, but I think it will not be very long from now that, you know, we will see the opening of Act Three, which will be the completion of his investigation and what that sets in motion in Congress. Potentially impeachment hearings for President Trump, depending on what Mueller finds. But even though we don't know the outcome of the investigation, I feel like we already know a great deal about what Mueller is investigating, and the story itself is really built around the events of 2016 and 2017. And we also know different kinds of conclusions. I don't think it's too early to look back on this period already and think that it's pretty clear that Vladimir Putin and Russia won, that their interference achieved a greater impact and created and caused more damage and dysfunction and confusion in the United States, largely compounded because of how Trump has conducted himself as president than we ever thought possible. So the book really is also an attempt to come to terms with that, sort of reckon with what this tells us about ourselves and in America as a increasingly frayed and fractured society.
Does the book also come to any conclusions regarding the president's role in working with the Russians?
Yeah, there are many, many areas of the book that deal with his financial connections with Russia, his attempts to do business deals there in terms of real estate developments and things like that. They're sort of painstakingly reconstructed his attempts to meet Putin over the years and the behind-the-scenes accounts from inside the Trump Tower meeting that Trump's son and close advisors had with Russian operatives saying that they were coming with damaging information on Hillary Clinton. We don't know, maybe Robert Mueller does, whether there is some kind of smoking gun memorandum out there in which Putin and Trump both agree in advance that they're going to try to work together to win the White House. I'm skeptical that we're ever going to see anything like that, but I think the amount of information that we have right now tells us that there was extensive, at least pulling in the same direction, if not explicit collusion or conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Trump presidency and Russia.
The president, we know he had for a long time before he became president, he had a show called The Apprentice, a reality TV show where people compete to work for him. What made you, besides the obvious reason that we know when we think of The Apprentice, it's Donald Trump, what made you decide to actually call the book The Apprentice?
When I thought of it, it worked on several levels. As you said, it's the name of the reality show that propelled him to such great fame in the United States. But, you know, it's also a term you could use to describe him in the start of his presidency. He was apprentice-like in his lack of preparation for the job. He had never held public office. He had never looked at a classified document, never run a government agency, really unfamiliar with the demands of the position and had to do a lot of learning on the job. You know, what the book is really focused on and built around is this mystery about his relationship with Vladimir Putin. Why is it that he seems so subservient to Putin at times, can never criticize him, always cultivating closer relationships with Putin, praises him, clings to the sort of Russian talking points, and can't accept the reality that Russia interfered in the U.S. election.
That is Pulitzer Prize-winning national security correspondent for The Washington Post, Greg Miller. And mind. His new book is titled The Apprentice: Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. A highly successful singer who had one of the biggest hits of 2018 has now just released a new single. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London talks about it with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
Today, Sarah, we're talking about a brand new song from one of the hottest female singers in music, Camila Cabello. We've talked about her before. She's back, and with her comes a bunch of new awards. She was just in Spain for the MTV Europe Music Awards show. She was the big winner of the night with 4 awards, including Artist of the Year and Song of the Year for Havana, the same 2 awards she had won a month earlier at the MTV Video Music Awards. She has a new song, which we're going to listen to today on our International Edition. This one's called Consequences, which is a true story based on a past relationship she had. So let's listen to Consequences, Camila Cabello.
Dirty tissues, trust issues, glasses on the sink, they didn't fix you. Lonely pillows and a stranger's bed, little voices in my head. Sacred keeping, stop the bleeding, lost a little weight because...
Okay, Larry, what about this relationship she had?
Well, it's a past relationship, and she's very, very private with her personal relationships and her personal life. She'll only reveal exactly what she wants you to know. One thing she wants you to know is that despite the tabloid, she is not pregnant. She said, yeah, I may have added a little bit of weight to my waist because I was on tour and I ate a lot on tour. She said, but please ignore my belly. I am not pregnant. The song Havana has been huge for her and has won Song of the Year at so many different award shows. And speaking of awards, Camila this year alone has won at the Billboard Women in Music. She won an American Music Award for New Artist of the Year and Favorite Pop Song, Billboard Achievement Award, Global Music Award for Best Female, Kids Choice Award for Favorite Breakout Artist. She's won many more, still nominated for many more. The song Havana has been viewed on YouTube 702 million times. And she was just on a headline tour. She was also touring with Taylor Swift earlier in the year. But she's one of the hottest artists to come. And all of this success, despite the fact she dropped out of high school in 9th grade at the Miami Palmetto High School. She's proud to say that eventually she did get her GED. And one day does hope to go to a college. Camila works with charity. She is closely connected to the Children's Health Fund, which provides health care for low-income children. And she's a role model for many kids, young and old, and she continues to tour. And this is only her first album. And for those that don't know, Camila was once a member of the group Fifth Harmony. She was the first one to leave, and then ultimately the entire group disintegrated from there. But she is off on a great solo career.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
From loving you was sunshine, but then it poured.
You're listening, or you've been listening, to International Edition. That does it for today's show. You can find us, though, anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA.